ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Best known for playing a fierce teen with a soft side in Heartbreak High, and a recently escaped delinquent on the run in Thou Shalt Not Steal, Sherry Lee Watson is preparing to make her theatre debut at Melbourne's Malthouse Theatre. So, what's behind Sherry's jump from screen to stage? I'm Amalia, and welcome to Away, the home of Indigenous arts and culture on ABC Radio National. I'm Rudy Bremer. Coming up, Sherry Lee Watson takes you into Break of Day's rehearsal room and discusses the challenge and joy of playing complicated teens. Then, NAIDOC Week is an invitation and opportunity to celebrate First Nations culture and communities. But in workplaces, that celebration needs to be done with care. Shanice Hamilton discusses how allies can help lighten the extra, often invisible, workload placed on mob during cultural events and celebrations. Plus, language legend Jade McHughes shares a little more Ngarrindjeri with you. So, stay with me here on Away. Growing up on an outstation outside Alice Springs, Sherry Lee Watson had to make her own entertainment. Often in the form of listening to country music or singing songs with her friends and family. The kind of muck around shows you do to pass the time. And it was playing like this that saw Sherry's love of performance blossom and led her to move south and attend a Victorian high school specifically for kids who dream of a career in the arts. Fast forward to now, and Sherry's gained recognition for her breakout role in Heartbreak High and earned her first actor nomination for her performance in the series Thou Shalt Not Steal. But after finding success with screen acting, the Arunda actor is keen to return to her first love, theatre. See, Sherry is about to star in her first ever play called Break of Day. Sherry joined me in the Away studio to talk about the new role and how those early years on the outstations sparked her love of performance.
I think it was because we were out of town and I didn't really have access to the town itself outside of going to school there, that I sort of needed to find a lot of things to do and occupy my time. And living on an outstation, we didn't have internet. We didn't have internet until like a couple of years ago. So I just got really into reading and singing in my bedroom and just really like getting into musical theatre and just nerding out about it by myself and just, yeah, developed this deep obsession for it and just knew that it's something I always wanted to do was be a performer of some sort. So I didn't know specifically what I wanted to do, but I think I found music theatre was going to kill three birds with one stone and just, you know, get as much as I possibly could in there.
You've got me curious. What was your fave musical theatre show or...
That's always such a hard question because there's so many as well. And I love Sondheim, anything Sondheim.
Oh.
I think around the time I auditioned for VCA was when Hamilton was really going off in the States. But I feel like I've sort of grown away from that. I think my favorite one now is a musical called Natasha, Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, do you know that one?
I know about it. I've not had a chance to see it.
So good. No one knows it. It's such a niche show, apparently.
Yeah.
But it's so beautifully written. It's by Dave Malloy and it's a chapter of, do you know the novel War and Peace?
Yeah.
It's one chapter of that, but it's like a 2-hour show and it's just stunning.
And very much kind of, it's occupying a similar space to Hamilton in that there has been like colour I don't know if it's colorblind or color conscious casting.
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, I don't know what the phrase we're using today is, but it's sort of like challenging the traditional norms of who do you expect to be cast in roles like this. Like the main character, she's an ingenue, and she very much is like sort of like a stereotype of this young girl who's a soprano and, you know, it needs to be quote unquote rescued, but then realizes that's maybe not what she wants. And, you know, like off-Broadway, she was played by Philippa Soo, who is in Hamilton, and she's Asian American. And then when it went to Broadway, it was played by a dark-skinned black woman. Mm. And you just like, even around, I think like 2016, 17, 18, like when it was coming out, that was sort of like not the norm. And it was really beautiful to see that, especially when I was at drama school, because, you know, you just weren't really seeing a lot of pieces like that and the casting decisions like that being made outside of Hamilton, I guess.
Yeah. Clearly you have a passion for stage, for musical theatre. Growing up, what were some of the moments that really kind of stuck out for you in terms of, I guess, realising that you have the potential to make this not just a hobby, not just a thing that you do while you work a 9-to-5 kind of day job, but this could be your life?
I think it was honestly just like a chance. Like I just took a chance with it. When I was 14, I was sponsored by this like charity organization called the Smith Family to come down to Victoria and finish my secondary schooling. I had a mentor who was at our school who was also part of the Smith Family organization, and she really encouraged me to sort of go and pursue my year 12 education. And I think it was just sort of this love of performing growing up. And, you know, and Alice Springs doesn't really have a lot of outlets for people who want to do music theatre, but also just like sort of any sort of drama based activities or anything like that. It wasn't really accessible for me there. And I didn't really consider it seriously or professionally until I went to my high school in Geelong, which had a really amazing performing arts program there. And I was really, really lucky to have an incredible teacher, Deb Hines, and also Lockie Joyce. They were just really good at encouraging me and kind of, you know, made me believe in myself a little to audition for the VCA. And I just had some really good mentors there that made me realize that I could do that. And I think I also just sort of had a bit of imposter syndrome around going to quite a fancy school and getting into a university. I didn't think I was going to get into a university in like an arts course or anything like that. So it actually just seemed like the most feasible thing for me to do was to audition for these drama schools, because my goal was to stay out of the NT. I couldn't go back to the Northern Territory after I graduated school. I knew that I wouldn't have been able to regain any momentum that I found while I was down here.
Other than obviously kind of the technique, what do you think you gain by being able to attend an arts college?
Well, you gain a lot of proximity to the industry, especially in Melbourne. You know, VCA is just sort of smack bang. It's right here in the middle of the arts precinct. And just like having that close proximity to like the NGV and all, like the theatre district in Melbourne, and just you're immersed in it. You're surrounded by like other people are creating. And it's just like it does something to you just being around other creatives and being in a place where it's safe to do stuff like that. Like you can walk around your campus and it's sort of like, oh, the music theatre kids, you know, they're like singing and dancing and being obnoxious again, but that's them. Like you're allowed to do that and sort of like be lame about it. And, you know, that's just like, it's just accepted. And I think that sort of like subconscious little creative freedom just really nurtures a little part of yourself that was definitely really integral for me going into this career. I think it gave me a lot of techniques to be brave in my creativity.
Sherry Lee, at the risk of setting up a false dichotomy, you've played Missy in Heartbreak High Robin in Thou Shalt Not Steal.
Yes.
You're set to appear in some upcoming TV shows, My Brilliant Career, yes, and also Breakers. So, like, you've really built a lot of momentum around being an actor on screen.
Mm.
So what's drawing you to your new show, Break of Day, at Malthouse Theatre?
Yeah. So many breaks.
Mm.
Heartbreak High, Breakers and Break of Day. You know, my CV. I miss it. I miss theatre so much. And it's where I'm happy. And it's so different to TV. It's so different to screen. And it's not that I didn't intend to go to screen. I just never saw it for me. I didn't think I would ever make it to screen in that sense. Because, you know, even when we were at uni, I'm not sure if the attitudes have changed now, but at uni, you know, we only did like a 6-week course on how to act on screen. They're very different acting styles, you know, like to be on stage, you have to be able to get your message out to the person who's sitting at the back of the room, but you also can't push it too hard so the person sitting in the front of the room is going to get hit with too much energy and like spit and stuff like that. But in screen, you know, the camera's right there and it sees everything in your face and you have to draw back your performance and make everything as clear but more subtle. They're just completely different muscles to flex. And, you know, I had gone from this really hardcore 5 days a week, 9 o'clock to 6 o'clock stage training. And I just happened to book a screen show like right after graduating. I'd done a show at Theatre Works when I came out of VCA, which is amazing. And it was incredible to sort of like lift off and do that as my first sort of professional show out. But yeah, I just happened to book Heartbreak High like around the same time as graduating. And I followed the momentum of screen and then told my agents maybe like about a year and a bit ago that I miss the stage. I miss the smell of it. I miss, you know, like this smoke, and I miss the adrenaline. I miss diving so deeply into the text that it's just sort of like in your blood and becomes intrinsic to you. And you go home and it's all you can think about. Like, I miss that. I miss becoming so enthralled in it. And you just don't do that with screen. Like, screen's like, you learn your lines, you get into it, you spend your time doing what you need to do, and then you shoot it and it's done.
Mm.
There's no coming back the next night to make new discoveries. And I just sort of, going through the motions of that just sort of became a bit soulless for me. And I love screen so much, and I love the people I've met. I love working with different crews all around Australia, because every state has their different film crew, and you know, you meet people from all different walks of life. Theatre is its own little bubble of people that you just sort of the worlds don't collide as much as you'd think they would. And so, like, yeah, I think I just miss theatre people as well, and I miss the feeling of it, and it's so intoxicating, and I'm just not getting that from screen right now.
And so you're still in rehearsal. Has this process of rehearsing lived up to the hope and the expectation when you made that ask of your agent a year ago?
Yeah, absolutely. It's only been a couple of days, but it's insane. I'm tired, but it's a good tired. It's like when you go to the gym for the first time in ages, and you're sore, but it's really nice for my brain.
Yeah. Take me into the rehearsal room a little. What has it been like?
Well, right now we've only sort of just gotten on the floor. We spend the first couple of days sort of looking at the script and meeting everybody in the cast, and we go through and we break down all of the beats in the script. And, you know, I think that took us a couple of days to get, I think we got to like just over 100 different beats. And it's a lot of sitting down, and it's a lot of stuff that you wouldn't do in film and TV because there's not enough time. And there's like, you just got to get your shot. You know, it's like, yep, okay, cool. I don't care about your life story. I just want to get the shot. And that's just so the opposite in theatre. Like, theatre's all about the connections with the people and the relationships you have with the people, I guess, on and off stage, and just the trust that you have to form in order to be doing these scenes with people so many times a week is like, it's so integral that you form those relationships really nicely in the first couple of weeks, I think, because you want to be able to trust people on stage. And you want to be able to trust that you can make like big, bold offers and that they're going to catch you. Mm-hmm. And it's just been really nice sort of like getting to know the cast really well and, you know, working with Sarah Goods, who's just an incredible director. And I'm really excited to be working with her, just the way that her brain works and watching her break things down and just watching someone with so much like experience and seasons is just, yeah, I'm learning so much more than I think I ever could have learned at drama school as well.
Mm. So you are playing Ray, who is a young girl in her final year of high school, and Kat Stewart is playing your mum.
Yes.
Now, she's someone else who's traversed that kind of stage and screen career very successfully.
Yes.
Has she had any advice for you as you've gotten to know each other?
I'm just like, just watching her, I'm learning so much. She learns her lines so quickly, and she has so many lines in this show. Even just watching her yesterday, I'm just like, wow, the way that her brain works is just something. Like, I'm just trying to soak up as much as I possibly can in the room. And, you know, Offspring was such a big show when I was in high school and stuff. And, like, just, like, I don't know, just I never really thought that I was ever going to be in a position where she's playing my mum. And she's so loving and caring, and her heart is so open. And her, like, it's just, she's such an artist. Oh, it's just so cool to be around that. And I'm just inspired, honestly. I think I'm just in awe and inspired. And I forget that I'm in the same show. Like, I feel like I'm sitting in the audience watching a masterclass half the time, just watching, you know, these beautiful artists just sort of go back and forth and develop this show. I forget that I'm also in the show. And I'm, you know, yeah.
What do you have to do to be able to bring yourself back into the moment?
I have to be put on the spot. And I need Sarah to be like, okay, you need to do the scene now. And I'm like, okay, yep, cool. It's nerve-wracking. It's really nerve-wracking and a different kind of vulnerability. Like, I've realized to be back in a stage where I can use my body and there's not a camera right near me and I have to stay on my mark. And, you know, it's taken a lot of gusto that I forgot that I needed to move my body around. But like Kat and Sarah, just they make you feel so safe and make you feel really good to make decisions and offers.
Yeah. You pointed out the very interesting pattern that you've got a lot of breaks in your But also just kind of looking at Heartbreak High, at Thou Shalt Not Steal, and now Break of Day, you've played characters who are just starting to come into their autonomy and entering young adulthood. Obviously, some of that is about you being a young artist, but in terms of that kind of character arc of finding your autonomy in the story, what do you love about that?
It's, you know, I feel like the older I get, the harder it is to play younger characters because you're not allowed to judge your character as an actor. And when I'm constantly playing teenagers who make really questionable decisions sometimes, I'm sort of just sitting there like, really? Like, I've got to support you in doing this? Okay. But it's like the characters that I've been blessed with they're so complex and they're so, like, the writing behind it. You know, there's so many people who've put their hearts into these characters that it's sort of made it a little easy for me to kind of plot along and just rock up and be there and stuff. And like, I was sort of just like preparing for a career of, you know, being in the ensembles and not really like getting to entertain any characters with a dimension or depth. And then when Missy came along, I was just sort of really taken aback by the fact that the people at Netflix and Fremantle trusted me with her. And I was like, really? Like, you want to give me this girl who's like really staunch, but she uses that like as a kind of facade to mask that she's actually really, really sensitive deep down. I was like, oh yeah, sure. Like, I'll do that. And then I realized I've just discovered so much about myself playing these characters because there's just so much truth in them. And Robin's the same, you know, like she's actually really deep, like a deep down, just like a little sensitive girl from the bush and has to do all of these hard crimes to survive. And I guess I grew up not expecting a lot of that because I didn't see a lot of that.
I mean, you mentioned that one of the challenges to these kinds of characters is trying not to judge them.
Yes.
What are there any other challenges that come with exploring those kinds of arcs?
Just holding your own and trusting that my own lived experiences come, like when I put that into these characters, that is enough. And, you know, like oftentimes when I feel like I have to justify the choices that I'm making, that takes away from the energy that I could otherwise be putting in my performance. And I think I've just playing such staunch characters has taught me just how to be more staunch in real life and just to be really strong with the boundaries that I have as an actor and, you know, just like learning how to advocate and look after myself in this industry. I've learned so much of that just through playing these characters and through putting that into my body and performing these scenes and like my body learning, hey, like it is okay to be assertive. Like I'm not being rude, I'm just being assertive.
Mm. And what are you learning about Ray as you get familiar with her through this rehearsal period?
Ray is a really beautifully complex character with so many layers. Stevie, the writer of the show, has just, every time I reread the script, I just find new things. He's put so much of his heart into the show and, you know, a lot of his own experiences in his life that I just, like, she's already such a complete person and a complete character. And she's, you know, she's this young girl who's completing her year 12 and she's really, 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 really bright. And she would be wasted in this small town of Borough Creek, which is where the play is set. Sort of this fringe satellite town, very low socioeconomic, working class people. And she's just really bright and she's like doing her school assignment on her year 12 extension assignment that was going to count towards like, I think like 90% of her ATAR score or something. Mm. And, you know, it's going to be the difference between her getting into a good uni and her not getting into one. And the stakes are really, really, really high. And you sort of see her struggling with this, but then struggling with just living in poverty and the mundane everyday life things that come with that. Because it's like, it's sort of really hard to explain to people who haven't experienced living in poverty. It's like, yeah, it sucks because there's not enough food and you're tired and you're probably not clean. But then there's also little things like you can't get your work done because you have visitors. Like you have other people who might rely on you who are coming in and out, or you have to go and do things for other family members. You have to look after other family members because they don't have access to good healthcare and they need looking after and they need caring for. And there are so many things that takes you out of just being a young kid trying to complete your year 12 when you live in such an unstable environment. And, you know, I feel like I can attest to a lot of this because it's, you know, I grew up with not a lot of money on an outstation in Alice Springs with a single mother. I would not have noticed that we'd grown up in poverty until I'd gone away and sat down and been like, oh, wow, like, you know, I've got like really amazing things here when I'm in Victoria, and I sort of go home and we don't have amazing things there. And it's, yeah, it's really, there's a lot of truth in this play. And it, yeah.
I think it's that thing of when you're living in an area that is lacking in resources, lacking in opportunity, you're not able to see it as clearly as when you are outside of that environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you suddenly realize what you didn't have.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
What are you most looking forward to in terms of when the show opens?
I'm really excited for people to see the story and to see the relationship between my character and Kat's character. You know, it's this mother and daughter who, despite all the hardships that they're going through, they still love each other at the end of the day. And, you know, family's always going to be there for one another despite what's going on in their lives. And it's just sort of this Stevie was saying yesterday, we were talking about my character, and this is really the first time in her life that she's realizing that the world's not black and white and two things can be true at once.
Mm.
There's no such thing as good and bad people. Good people can do bad things and vice versa. Just so much more complicated than, you know, good versus evil. And it's like when you're living in poverty, it's like the decisions that people make define them that day, perhaps, because it's like they've got to get through to the next day and then the next day and then the next day. And it's like, it's just a different world. And I'm really excited for people to see that and to come, you know, Malthouse, I love the shows that they put on, but I haven't really seen anything like this there before. And I think it's going to really leave a really lasting impression on a lot of audience members.
How much did you know about Break of Day before it kind of came across your desk in terms of like to audition?
I was sent the script probably about a year ago-ish to audition for it. Originally, when I told my agents that I wanted to get back into theatre, they sort of were like, oh, okay, we're just going to kind of take it really slowly and just maybe organise some meetings. And I wanted to catch up with Reese, who is the casting director at Malthouse, because I've just sort of known them from they've started their own casting agency called Evolution Casting. And, you know, I'd sort of like caught up with them over the years, and they were at MTC at one point, and I just wanted to sit down and have a coffee with them. And I was like, I want to go back on stage. I don't want like a big long run. I don't want to do any commercial shows. I don't want to do music theatre right now. I just want something that's going to be creatively fulfilling and just like something gritty and something nice. And they had me in the back of their head for a while, and they said they're always looking for like roles to audition me for that I can fit in and that will fit in with my time schedule. And this one came along, and they said they got so excited and wanted to audition for me and put me through the rounds, and I ended up making it to callbacks. And, you know, I was up against a few people for it and just ended up getting it. And I think from when I first read the script, because it's gone through a few changes, I just, like, whenever I read a script of a character that I need, like, I want to play, it's, like, similar with Robin and Thou Shalt Not Steal, you know, like, she's pitched as an Arinda girl from Jay Creek, which is literally the mission that I am from. Like, I've, you know, that's, like, where my family live. And when Dylan wrote that originally, he didn't know that when he auditioned everybody. And he apparently auditioned so many people before. I think I was one of the last people they saw. And in my tape, I was like, my name's Shirley Watson. I'm an Arinda girl from Alice Springs. I was like, this role's perfect for me. And I needed it. I was hungry and I was, like, not sleeping. And sometimes when I come across roles like that, and this was another one, Ray was another one, I was like, I need this. I will get, like... I'm going to not be happy if I don't get it. Yeah. And I knew I was up against some amazing actors, incredible actors that I know. And when I found out that I was up against like some of my friends, I was like, oh, I'm not going to get this. It's, you know, I sort of let it go, which I think was the best thing that I could have done, because then I ended up just kind of doing the callback with a little bit less tension than I would have gone in with. And I think that's what ultimately landed me the part.
Oh, amazing. You know, I know that you said that you're not quite ready to or looking to do a big, like, musical theatre piece, but I'm curious, what would be a dream role in that sort of genre?
I would love to play Sonia in Great Comet of 1812. Mm-hmm. I just love the songs that she sings, and I think that's just like a little cheeky, like, I'd love to do that because I love the singing in it. I'd love to do anything Sondheim. Oh my god, I would love to do Sunday in the Park with George.
Oh.
Like, that is my dream show. You know, you don't really see a lot of Sondheim in Australia.
No, you really
these
don't.
Days. Yeah. I think it's just such a niche audience to sort of like, you know, and I always tell this to people because it's this weird thing where people make it like a whole personality trait where they don't like music theater. And then I sit there and I'm like, why? And they're like, oh, it's just lame. It's just not realistic. And I'm like, it's theater. It's heightened. It's not supposed to be realistic. Yeah. It's we're seeing a character's in a monologue. Like we're seeing what's happening inside of their head and it's, you know, being played out through song. And I sort of like always have this spiel that I give people when they say they hate music theater. And I'm like, but have you considered looking at it through this? Have you considered looking at it through, you know, like we're just seeing this play out through song and dance and it's a heightened moment. And it's like people start singing when they can't speak anymore. It's just their emotions are too big. It's like Shakespeare. You get these really, really big ideas and you bring it down to something that's easier to sort of digest, you know, you're concerning big philosophical ideas and music theatre is just such a beautiful outlet for that. And I just like Sondheim is the same way that like jazz is the musician's music. I feel like Sondheim is the MT performer's music theatre. You know, he didn't, you know, bless his soul, rest in peace. He did not write these shows to be aesthetically pleasing. He orchestrates them in a way where the pulse of the music is the character's heartbeat or, you know, the little twinges in the notes are them having a thought out of nowhere. And watching an actor who understands that is just so magical and just something I would love to be able to do.
Sherry Lee Watson there. She's making her theatre debut at Malthouse Theatre on August 7 to 29. The show is called Break of Day, and if you want to catch Sherry's performance, visit malthousetheatre.com.au for tickets and show dates. I'll pop a link on Away's show page too. I'm Rudy Bremer, and you're listening to Radio National. NAIDOC Week has wrapped for another year, and it was a big one. I don't know about you, but it feels like NAIDOC genuinely gets bigger every year. But with that growth comes extra, often invisible work. Work that's typically placed on mob. I know that over the past weeks, I've certainly taken on extra work. But what about my non-Indigenous friends and colleagues?
All Stars Ball.
Can you say it as a full sentence?
As in, like, I celebrated NAIDOC at the All Stars Ball.
I went to.
I went to the All Stars Ball.
What extra work did you take on for NAIDOC Week?
Me? None.
I didn't do too much extra or different, to be honest. I listened to more programming from First Nations people than I otherwise would. I listened to, wasn't NAIDOC specific, but your trials interview, which I loved. And extra work beyond my everyday work, not much.
I watched that Blackfella show and we interviewed an Indigenous organisation in the Kimberley, but it wasn't really extra work. We did the same amount of stories that we would normally do, but we had Indigenous guests, so no, we didn't do extra work for NAIDOC Week.
So I did my day job and I made programmed celebrating Black music, but I've got to say, Rudy, a lot of the work that happened towards those programs was done by you.
I'd call you daily to check in on how you were going, and I try to push for a couple more stories about it, but overall, I probably should get you a cake at some stage.
So it's not the most scientific of studies, but you get the picture. Overwhelmingly, cultural events like NAIDOC Week are enjoyed by everyone, but the heavy lifting of organising is often shouldered by Blackfellas. It's something Wiradjuri and Bundjalung woman Shanice Hamilton knows all about. She's a facilitator with Evolve Communities and helps to bridge gaps in cultural understanding between mob and corporations. Shanice joined me in the Away studio to discuss the idea of cultural load, starting with what that term actually means.
Cultural load is referring to the effects and the impacts of colonisation and genocide. It's a load that Indigenous First Nations people carry the minute that they put their feet on the floor in the morning and carry that throughout their everyday.
I have heard it sometimes referred to as colonial load in an acknowledgement that the weight or the pressure is from the colony rather than our culture.
That's correct.
Whatever we call it, what we're actually referring to is that expectation that we will do heavy lifting without recognition and without pay. How do you see that play out during cultural events like NAIDOC Week?
I think it's the lack of awareness that causes the load to be so heavy. It plays out in the sense of the lack of cultural awareness and intelligence from non-Indigenous people that really lean heavily on Indigenous people to guide them. And a lot of the time it is out of fear of getting it wrong and wanting to be respectful. However, it is an opportunity for non-Indigenous people to do their own independent research and learnings about, you know, how they can lighten the load, how they can educate themselves, and how they can be supportive in that space for Indigenous people.
Do you have examples?
Yes, yes. I have an example. I have lots of examples, but I'll choose one. One that stands out in my mind is a time where I worked in a government organisation, very, very reliant on keeping community safe. The sorry day was approaching and the manager of the office approached myself and another First Nations officer that worked in my office, saying, would we mind catering and organising and leading sorry day for the non-Indigenous staff? We went out and we did our shopping for everyone and went back and laid it all out. Yeah, had a get together while the other workers, you know, maintaining their workload and their regular paid job duties. We had that extra load that was not within our work scope. And then I asked my manager after the day if she was aware of what sorry day signified and what it actually meant. Unfortunately, to my surprise, she did not. She confessed that she did not know what sorry day was actually about.
What is so powerful about that as an example is that it is something that so many of us have experienced, whether it is Sorry Day, Reconciliation Week, NAIDOC Week. I have been thinking about that kind of tension, that push-pull that exists in wanting non-Indigenous colleagues, wanting allies and friends to step up, but knowing that so often the understanding of the cultural event, the significant moment, is surface level. NAIDOC Week is another example where this is a cultural event that is grounded in protest. As much as I celebrate NAIDOC Week and think of it as an honouring and a celebration, it's also a time to have really challenging conversations. And that's the thing that, in my experience, non-Indigenous people are less aware of and less comfortable with.
Yeah, I truly, honestly believe the way to reconciliation is being challenged, being motivated, being inspired, getting over that feeling of feeling uncomfortable because you don't want to step on toes, you don't want to do the wrong thing, you don't want to be disrespectful. I re- from the bottom of my heart, believe that the time for sitting on the fence and thinking that's okay these days is not okay. That is not supportive of reconciliation or inclusion for us all to be one, to walk as one, which from our cultural perspective is that we are one, we are all connected. So I think that it is so much deeper than just a name at a date. Culture is embedded in people's lives. It intertwines between the personal and the business. There is space that's created for cultural yarns and discussions within staff meetings on a regular basis, on a weekly basis. The only way that we are going to make any positive change for our country and for everyone that calls these lands home is if we are actively and proactively having these cultural yarns that are very, very important. And then when the day comes, it won't be that, oh, the non-Indigenous people have to really lean heavily on First Nations people to guide them. They will know. And if they need reassurance, then they check in. This is what I found. I would like to do this. Is that the respectful and the culturally safe way to go about it?
What are some of your hot tips or advice that you would give to allies who want to be able to do that?
I always say to allies, the first step is that they're willing and wanting to be curious. They want to go on a cultural journey. I always say it is not time frames. You learn and grow as you need to in the pace that you need to. There is no end to your cultural journey. So take your time, intertwine your personal life and your business life with including like your cultural learnings. Don't be afraid to get it wrong. Just know in your heart that you're asking these questions or attempting to do the right thing with the knowledge that you actually have. If you get it wrong, that's okay. We get things wrong in our workplace, in our professional life, in our home, and that's okay. And I know that this has happened before. People have gone on their cultural journey, they've gone got it wrong, and then they've come back, I'm not doing that again. So they stop the journey. That's not the way. It's just circular. It's ongoing. We learn and we grow. So if they get it wrong, know in their heart that they did the right thing. They had the good intentions. I got it wrong. Share that mistake with other people so that they're aware. It's all about storytelling. Share your experiences, your setbacks, and your good news stories in, you know, culture, in your cultural journey as an ally. It has to be proactive. It has to be daily, front of mind.
Shanice Hamilton from Evolve Communities there. If you want to know more about the workplace experiences of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, UTS's Centre for Indigenous Peoples and Work produced a report into the subject earlier this year. It's called Gariyala 2, Speak the Truth, and our TIDR program Speaking Out took a deep dive into the findings when it was released. You'll find it on ABC Listen. I'm Rudy Bremer. You're listening to Away on Radio National, and it's time now for Word Up. Jade McHughes is a Ngurundjeri Minmini and your language legend this month. For Word Up this week, Jade is sharing the Ngurundjeri word for a beloved bird.
Pukulba means happy.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia. One word at a time.
Kinagai.
Birluin.
Walter.
Kalang.
Badjili.
Ngalungir.
Bambach.
Dyangye.
Injamara.
Guram.
Mijal.
Reipiri.
Ngaraguche nama.
Gani warangung.
Munyip.
Domaninialka. Wakaniniana.
Wardadawiya.
Ngundingi dangan.
Wukuk.
Kuwayu.
Delkup.
Tiepa.
Murupuk.
Hey everyone, it's Jade McHughes again, Ngadanjeri Mimini from South Australia. The word that I'm sharing with you today is Richirooki, which is one of my favourite words to say because it just sounds cool. Richirooki is a willy wagtail, and they remind me of my nan, the way they flit around. And you'll find that lots of different Aboriginal groups around the nation have got stories about their Richirooki or however, whatever word the willy wagtail is for them. I've heard that when a willy wagtail or Richirooki visits, that they've either got a message for you or that there's a visitor. My nan was really connected with willy wagtails and would point them out all the time, but they'd also be hanging around while we were in the garden or the front yard or whatever. But there's also a Richirooki or two that every time I'm down at Ratalung on Ngadanjeri Rui, sometimes I walk some people through and do some yarning while we're there, and there's a Richirooki that like hangs out with us the whole way. but I love them.
Word Up, bringing you the diverse languages of Black Australia, one word at a time.
That was Jade McHughes sharing some of her language, Ngadanjeri. You can find the full series of Word Up on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. That's the show for this week. Thanks for your company. Away was produced on the lands of the Gadigal by Ruby Ritchie and me, Rudy Bremer. Technical production by Harvey O'Sullivan. We'll have more Indigenous arts and culture for you next week on Radio National, or catch us anytime you like on ABC Listen, along with Word Up and our Titter program Speaking Out, hosted by Larissa Berendt. Until next time, I'm Rudy Bremer. Yalu.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.